it's not an exaggeration when we say that Delhi became a toxic gas chamber.
We will take you to what has been the most polluted city in the world. This is Thursday, November 7th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can be part of that program. The invitation is out. Just join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, many say the United States did not treat the ASEAN meeting with respect. And you'll hear how dangerous it is in the south of Thailand. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. In the Indian capital of New Delhi, authorities declared a public health emergency this month as air pollution levels hit hazardous levels, a problem that the city wrestles with in winter months when stagnant winds and cooler temperatures hold the toxic air over the city. Doctors warn that the dirty air is extracting a serious toll on the health of the city's 20 million residents. Palki Sharma is the executive editor and anchor of We on TV, one of the largest English-language TV networks based in New Delhi. She joins us now by telephone. Palki, how bad is the air in your city?
So right now, things are much better, but on Sunday, it was very bad. It was hazy. You could feel it in your eyes. If you stood on top of a building, you could feel that the smog was so thick, you could cut it with a knife into pieces. People did not go out. Playgrounds were empty. Schools had to be shut. It was very bad. It's not an exaggeration when we say that Delhi became a toxic gas chamber.
You had a scathing editorial type piece on one of your broadcasts yesterday on WeOn. Tell us something about what you had to say in that.
Paint a very good picture of India or Delhi when your national capital is breathing this kind of air, and we cannot provide, after 70 years of independence, something as basic as clean air and clean water to our people.
What else can the government do to help the situation?
A lot. The government can do a lot. Another thing that I mentioned in my editorial yesterday was that the government and all the agencies together seem to be guilt-tripping people by saying, do not burn firecrackers on Diwali, do not use private vehicles, but we do not have a very robust public transport system. So the people who have to go to work, the people who have to go to hospitals, the people who have to send their children to school, they have to use something to commute. And the buses and local trains are not enough, not nearly enough, to deal with the load. So people drive cars and people ride bikes. And yes, vehicular traffic contributes to 40% of pollution, and passenger cars make 10% of this emission. So yes, this is a problem. But to solve it, you have to provide alternatives to people. So the government can do that. The government can ensure that they act before things become so bad, because this has become an annual tradition now.
You are raising a family in New Delhi. How has it affected you?
Well, I do not remember a time when every room in your house had air purifiers. We are actively looking for plants to keep in our house. I have two young children, and I'm very worried about the kind of life they're leading in the capital. There are lots of opportunities here, but at the same time, if you're breathing this air, then, you know, one report says that this toxic air is cutting the life expectancy of each individual by 7 years. Another report said that cancer cases are up by 300% in India. 1.5 million people are dying because of pollution-related diseases every year in this country. This is bigger than terrorism. This is bigger than anything that you can inflict on a people. So I'm very worried. There are many complex problems, but there has to be a solution. Artificial rain is one, though the people are divided on that. We can have more trees. We can ensure that the farmers are subsidized and given better alternatives. A lot can be done, but the problem is that most of the political leaders remain in denial. We've had union ministers treating things like eat carrots and broccoli to ensure that you evade the ill effects of pollution. This is how seriously they take this. And I don't know how much action can we expect.
Palki Sharma is the executive editor and anchor of We on TV, one of the largest English-language TV networks based in New Delhi. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines. The dollar fell against the Japanese yen and drifted lower versus other currencies on Wednesday, with the markets in consolidation mode, investors seeking more clarity about the ongoing U.S.-China trade negotiations. The U.S. was very encouraged by a recent meeting between the leaders of South Korea and Japan, according to a senior U.S. diplomat, amid heightened tensions that could undercut three-way security cooperation on North Korea. A Bangladeshi plan to burn more coal for power will worsen global warming in a nation already battered by climate crises, from floods to cyclones, according to a report that went out on Wednesday. About 3% of that country's power comes from coal, that plans to build 29 coal-based power plants in the next two decades. VOA Asia continues. U.S. President Donald Trump sent a low-ranking delegation to important summits with Southeast Asian leaders this past week, triggering concerns about Washington's commitment to the region as a strategic partner. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sora has the story.
On the world stage, showing up matters. At this week's East Asia and ASEAN summits, President Trump did not attend, nor did he send his vice president or secretary of state. Adhering to diplomatic protocol, Southeast Asian leaders did not show up for the U.S.-ASEAN meeting either. Sending their foreign ministers to meet National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, Trump's special envoy for the summits.
As he said in his letter, President Trump wants to assure you of the rock-solid American commitment in word and deed to our friends, allies, and partners in ASEAN.
O'Brien extended Trump's invitation to Southeast Asian leaders to a summit in the U.S. early next year. Brian Harding is the Southeast Asia Program Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I'm sure they'll take the invitation seriously. There is an interest in the United States being more deeply engaged for making a joint trip to the United States.
Until then, critics say Washington's viewpoint is missing on regional negotiations, including on free trade, where China is dominating. A new economic agreement initiated by Beijing is underway at the summit. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, is expected to launch next year. It will account for a third of global gross domestic product and nearly half the world's population. Liu Cheng is the Chinese vice foreign minister.
It definitely will play a crucial role in promoting regional economic integration and cooperation across the board, especially on trade and investment.
Another multilateral deal, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, is also moving along without Washington. The Trump administration prefers bilateral trade agreements, but has not yet struck any in the region. Brian Harding of CSIS.
Japan has really slow-walked the bilateral trade negotiations as much as they can. Vietnam, who seemed to be a possibility, is just not interested. The Philippines is not interested. They look at how the United States has treated its closest allies and partners, Canada, Mexico, Europe, Korea, and they don't want anything to do with it.
Meanwhile, the trade war between the U.S. and China continues to worry ASEAN leaders. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, White House.
Happening now in Asia, Vietnam could explore legal action among various options in its territorial dispute with powerful neighbor China in the South China Sea. That according to a senior government official. Frictions have grown between the two communist-run nations since Beijing in July sent a ship for a month-long seismic survey to an area internationally designated as Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. Today, November 8th. Marks the third anniversary of Donald Trump's 2016 election as the 45th president of the United States. Trump remains a force of nature in American politics, but the third anniversary of his rise to power comes at a time when he's facing the gravest threat yet to his presidency, an impeachment inquiry led by congressional Democrats over his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
3 years have passed since that November night when Donald Trump shocked the world with his election as the nation's 45th president.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
That early appeal for unity faded long ago.
But the more America achieves, the more hateful and enraged these crazy Democrats become.
Trump is now counting on his loyal base of supporters to first withstand impeachment and then carry him to re-election next year.
At stake in this fight is the survival of American democracy itself. Don't kid yourself. That's what they want. They are destroying this country, but we will never let it happen, not even close.
The impeachment probe in the House is focused on Trump's alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. Biden has made Trump the issue in his bid to win the Democratic Party's presidential nomination next year.
He talks about there will be a civil war. This is a guy that's unhinged. He is unhinged. I worry about what he's going to do, not about me or my family. I worry about what he'll do in the next year in the presidency.
Like so much in Trump's presidency, the impeachment inquiry is playing out along party lines, says analyst John Fortier.
For Democrats, they believe the president has done something wrong, and they think they're going to bring out more evidence. And I think their hope is that that will turn public opinion against the president, perhaps allow him to be removed. Republicans, I think, are looking at past precedent to say this could be something that backfires on Democrats or at least doesn't catch fire.
Polls show Trump's approval rating at just above 40%, historically weak for an incumbent president trying to fight off impeachment and seeking re-election at the same time. But underestimating Trump's hold on his political base is dangerous, says Republican strategist John Feary.
Are the Washington pundits, is everyone inside the Beltway missing it about Trump? Absolutely. They don't have any clue this guy's real appeal at a visceral level. But one of the reasons why they support him is because he keeps his promises and he's got the economy going.
Even if Trump is eventually impeached by the democratically controlled House, he would likely survive an impeachment trial in the Republican-controlled Senate, says analyst William Galston.
I have believed since the very beginning of impeachment talk, which started up more than a year ago, that if the Democrats are to remove President Trump from office, it will have to be through the electoral process in 2020. Nothing that I've seen so far inclines me to change my mind in the slightest.
3 years into the tumultuous presidency of Donald Trump, Americans are now girding themselves for the prospect of both a partisan battle over impeachment and perhaps the most fiercely contested election in recent memory. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Coming your way, a massacre of government forces in Thailand. This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
A news update from VOA Asia. China and France signed contracts totaling $15 billion during a visit by President Emmanuel Macron, that according to a Chinese government official. Deals were struck in the fields of aeronautics, energy, and agriculture, including approval for 20 French companies to export poultry, beef, and pork to China. This is VOA Asia. Gunmen in insurgency Iraq, southern Thailand killed 15 village defense volunteers and wounded 5 security personnel in what is believed to be the deadliest attack on government forces since the separatist rebellion began 15 years ago. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
A Thai army spokesman said blood-stained clothing found at the scene suggested that some of the attackers on 2 checkpoints in Yala province late Tuesday night also may have been wounded in the exchanges of gunfire. The spokesman added four of the slain officers were women and one was a doctor. A senior police official described what appeared to be a coordinated attack. Nails were scattered on a highway to disable vehicles entering Yala. A small explosive device was found near an electrical pole to knock out power, and several burning tires were left at a school. Thailand's volunteer forces in the south are recruited from villages and receive weapons training from the army, but no salary. They are usually issued shotguns, but often carry personal handguns and only guard their own villages rather than seek to confront the insurgents. Over 7,000 people have been killed since the insurgency erupted in 2004 in Thailand's three southernmost provinces, the only ones with Muslim majorities in the Buddhist-dominated country. Muslim residents have long charged that they are treated like second-class citizens, and separatist movements have been periodically active for decades. Heavy-handed crackdowns have fueled the discontent. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
The president of Mexico, Andres Obrador, has rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's call to wage war on organized crime in that country. Trump offered U.S. help in an effort to wipe out drug cartels in Mexico in response to a massacre of nine U.S. family members on a road in northern Mexico. The Mexican president said Mexico would act with independence and sovereignty in pursuing the criminals behind the attack, but rejected the idea of going after them with arms. VOA's Latisha Hook reports the increasingly aggressive behavior of Mexican drug lords raises questions about just who controls the country.
A burnt-out vehicle was found by the side of a road with remains of some of the victims. Three women and their 14 children were traveling in a convoy between the Mexican states of Sonora and Chihuahua when they were attacked by suspected drug cartel gunmen. Trump told Mexico's President Andrés Obrador in a tweet that the cartels have become too powerful and it was time for Mexico to wage war on them with U.S. help. Obrador responded that gunning down gang members would not solve the problem.
Of course, we didn't want this to happen, but we do not think that riddling them with bullets, slaughtering, using force, blood and fire will solve the problem.
Mexico has long battled organized crime, and as gangs became more powerful than the local police, the government deployed military troops to handle them. Despite the effort, killings by cartels have increased. Mexico has registered nearly a quarter million homicides in the last 12 years, many linked to wars between rival drug cartels. Mexico's interior minister said the massacred U.S. family may have fallen victim to a turf war between two groups.
The convoy, composed of two suburban vans, may have been confused for criminal gangs that fight for control in the region.
Powerful drug lords are believed to have divided Mexico into areas of control, and there are allegations of collusion between local police and gangs. The country's central government appears to be no match to these entrenched and ever more powerful armed groups. U.S. Senator Mitt Romney, a rare Republican who sometimes criticizes Trump, said Tuesday the president is right to demand action against Mexican criminal groups near the U.S. border.
We have a good relationship with Mexico, and yet what's happening along the border with regards to these cartels and the increasing level of violence is a real concern to us and I think to the Mexican government and how to deal with it. This has been something that Mexico's been working on for a long, long time, and there's still a problem, and it's getting worse. And so the president says, look, let's get serious about it, and has indicated that he'd be willing to help, and I think that's the right sentiment.
Mexico's president said he wants to talk to Trump about cooperation in the fight against organized crime, but also preserve Mexico's sovereignty. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia, China's vice premier said Wednesday that Beijing supports more aggressive measures to tackle the unrest that has roiled the Chinese-ruled city of Hong Kong for more than 5 months. At a meeting with Hong Kong's embattled leader, Carrie Lam, he said anti-government protests were damaging the one-country, two-system formula under which the city has been governed. A bakery located in a suburb of Long Island, New York, is being held as a symbol of interfaith harmony by the local population and the media. VOA's Anshuman Aptev visited the bakery and spoke to its Pakistani-American owner to find out why people of different faiths are attracted to it.
When the previous owner of Beach Bakery Grand Cafe decided to sell it a few years ago, the news concerned residents of Westhampton Beach, home to area's large Jewish population. After all, the bakery had been serving their dietary needs for almost three decades.
Since my family is kosher, we appreciated that because there's no other kosher place in the area.
The Jewish community was concerned if the new owner would keep kosher or abide by Jewish dietary restrictions. But Rashid Suleri, who bought Beach Bakery Grand Cafe in 2018, met with community members and assured them he would do just that.
I gave a speech in the local synagogue. About 800 of their members listened to what I had to say. It was also being broadcast live to almost 4.1 million other viewers. We have their certificate, and anybody can come and see if we are kosher or not.
While Rashid kept the bakery kosher by adhering to kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws, he also ensured that the food preparation met the halal standards as per his own Muslim faith.
Kosher or halal?
The main difference between kosher and halal food comes from the way meat is handled and prepared. So we decided to get rid of meat from our menu. So when you are not serving meat, the dairy and vegetarian products, if they meet the kosher requirement, they are automatically halal. The other challenging thing was the alcoholic drinks. So we decided to get rid of them too.
After the changes, along with its large Jewish customer base, the area's Muslim community started visiting the bakery in large numbers.
When my kids heard about this place, we felt that we should all pay a visit.
Most of the stuff that's here, you can't find it in a lot of the places.
It shows the open-mindedness of this community.
They meet each other and have conversations. They try to understand each other. And that's why the bakery is well-regarded in this community.
With its kosher and halal food, the Beach Bakery Grand Cafe has become an example of religious integration in the Westhampton Beach area. But for owner Rashid Suleri, like any other popular eatery, the mouth-watering food is the best reason to visit his cafe. Aushman Apte, VOA News.
Imagine being paralyzed by a stroke for years. Some researchers at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine are trying to help in ways that traditional physical therapy cannot, by connecting the brain to the computer and using virtual reality. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more from Los Angeles.
David Karcham remembers exactly when his life changed forever.
It was actually 10 years, 3 months, and 3 days ago.
That's when Karcham experienced a stroke while driving. He was able to pull over and get help, but the left side of his body was paralyzed. While traditional physical therapy helped a little initially, brain-computer interface and virtual reality are helping him regain movement more than 10 years after his stroke.
If somebody can't move their arm in the real world, we can augment that in the virtual world and take their body's attempt to move and make it seem like they're moving in the virtual world.
Occupational therapist and neuroscientist Sukli Liu says when someone has a stroke, there is a blockage in the brain that cuts off blood flow. But virtual reality through brain-computer interface may help encourage the brain to find new routes and bypass the blockage. In this study, electrodes are placed on the scalp and on the arm muscles. They're connected to the computer and this virtual world. The user has to try to move this virtual arm with their real arm or with their mind.
We hope that showing them a virtual arm that moves, that maybe they can feel like is a little bit of their own body, that helps to reinforce and kind of reward the motor attempt. And then it should strengthen the brain activity related to controlling motor abilities.
Karcham says working with a virtual arm has helped him extend his arm and move his wrist and fingers.
It's improved my walking ability.
But Karcham says the positive effects of a session like this only last for a few months. Researchers are working on a more portable version of this technology for participants to take home and continue studying how brain-computer interface and VR can help stroke patients gain a better quality of life. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineers, Zineb Abdelrahman, and our managing editor, Diane Gao, with our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and our interns, Hai Young and Afra. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.